Dear brethren, our next speaker is Brother Jerry Leslie, who we have appreciated and also heard many times, even from our own platform. Appreciate his very sober and sound counsel in various aspects of Christian life and doctrine. This morning he has chosen a subject which may appeal in some respects to both those areas. His subject is heart and head. We're pleased to introduce Brother Jerry Leslie.
I would like to offer an apology for some citations yesterday. After our service yesterday, Sister Sharon mentioned to me that she said, there's not 24 verses in Genesis 6. And when we were going through the events of Noah's year, I was citing Genesis 6, a number of verses. And if you're taking any notes, all those early events that are referred to Genesis 6 are really Genesis 7. So it was just a misreference in my notes. Brethren, I'd like to ask you a question. What matters to you? What really matters to you? What concerns you? What are the issues of your life? What will affect your destiny, your role? How do issues arise and how are they resolved? Does control and understanding of deep concerns depend on your social position, on what others do or say? Or do they find resolution within your own being? Does it make any difference how we really see matters? How we are compelled and constrained by outward circumstances peculiar to our health, our family, or our economics? This will not be simply a self-help message expounding the power of positive thinking. We want to explore some tools to build with our outward relations and empower the inner new creature. First, we observe the age-old emphasis on either the heart or the head. Psalms 139:23 mentions both of these. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. We understand the heart as the inner self that thinks, feels, and desires. The true character or personality, it is pure or evil, sincere or hard, obedient or rebellious. God knows the heart of each person. The head or mind is more associated with the intellect, knowledge, and the academic part of life associated with facts. David uses both these faculties to admonish his son in 1 Chronicles 28:9. And thou, Solomon, my son, know thou the God of thy father, and serve him with a whole heart and with a willing mind. For the Lord searcheth all hearts and understandeth all the imaginations of the thoughts. One might contend that unless we get the facts and truth straight, there is no basis for character. And they might use Proverbs 4, verses 5 and 6, the basis for this line of reasoning. Get wisdom, get understanding, forget it not, neither decline from the words of my mouth. Wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom, and with all thy getting, get understanding. Another might contend with Paul that knowledge tends to pride, and they could use 1 Corinthians 13, verse 1, and that by keeping the heart, the issues of life will be resolved, Proverbs 4:23. We contend these two aspects of our nature cannot really be separated or one ignored without debilitating the other. We observe Adam's decision to disobey was with knowledge and intellect, thereby incurring responsibility and consequences of the curse. But can you imagine the heart involved when Eve handed him the forbidden fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? There was fear of loneliness, sorrow for her choice, and a reckless daring to reach beyond obedience. His mind yielded to the feelings of his heart. We are all born as victims of this imbalance, often yielding to feelings while the head loses its direction. But there are also examples where the head overpowers the heart. In Peter's case, his heart was right, but he was not sufficiently armed with a deep assurance of the facts of the case. Charges of being with Jesus, watching the trial proceedings, and the travesty of justice overpowered his heart, and it trembled for a moment. There were other examples of the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and later the Gnostics, whose intellectual powers alone ruled over the humility of heart and character that might have otherwise prevailed. There was Solomon, who began with a humble heart and a strong intellect, whose heart turned to pleasure of the flesh, while his better judgment turned the other way. In our century, there were those during the Holocaust whose weak heart paralyzed them in the face of terror and propaganda. In reality, the whole person must have full access to both head and heart. The heart is defined as that faculty which feels, identifies with any issue. In Acts 11:23, it is expressed as the purpose of the heart. The heart is compared to the sail of a ship, and the intellect to the rudder. The heart is defined as the faculty that catches the wind. The head, that which steers its direction. And brethren, it is a disaster to be at sea without both a sail and a rudder. However, to the one that is busy trimming his sails, it may seem that the intellectual pursuits are countering the and impeding the focus, his focus and efforts. To the one charting his course through the pools of doctrine, philosophy, and truth or fabrication, may view the heart as an emotional diversion not to be trusted. In reality, we need not only each other, but we need strong ingredients of both in our own hearts and our minds, in our own constitution. No one sets out to discover new worlds without a map, but also with a strong heart and courage and hope. Sometimes the journey dulls the edge of either joy or judgment, and the ocean begins to flood the decks, the lower decks of our vessels. We may be carrying excess ballast in the lower rooms of the heart or driven onto rocks by broken rudders of the mind. There is something for us to do in these matters. I am not of those who believe that having once turned our life over to God ends our work or decision process, that our burdens just melt away and that joy accompanies us every day without some deep endeavor and participation. There are things that we can and that we must do. 2 Timothy 2:15 uses the word study. It's properly rendered to give diligence, but I think the thoughts are closely related. Study, or give diligence to show thyself approved unto God. a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. And so we are to study, to give diligence to God's word. Study our life and times. Study God's will. The noblest employment of the mind is the study of our Creator's works. Proverbs 1:7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. The reverence with which this is pursued is expressed in Isaiah 66:2. All those things hath my hand made, and all those things have been, saith the Lord, but to this man will I look, even to him that is poor and of a contrite spirit, and trembleth at my word. Reverence begets wisdom. It is a rule that will cut us to the bone if it is neglected. There is no learning without reverence. Education does not consist merely in studying languages and learning facts. True instruction sows seed for future use and springs forth into godly endeavor and activity. But without study, there is no seed for divine sanction. Our devotion to God is not merely an emotional attachment. A tree is known by its fruit, a man by his deeds. And good deeds are never lost. Let me repeat that. Good deeds are never lost. Action without study is fatal, just as study without action is fatal. Colossians 1:10. That ye might walk worthy of the Lord unto all pleasing, being fruitful in every good work, and increasing in the knowledge of God. But how do we grow in ways that we know that we are deficient? First, brethren, we acknowledge that we are the students, and that we need teachers. We listen to those who traveled this way before. Over the course of my experiences and learning process in the world, I've attended a number of seminars, and it's become increasingly popular to challenge the instructor, sometimes in quite rude and blatant ways. It's always very disturbing to me is why we're in this class, and yet the students will challenge and talk down the teacher many times. Each generation tends to distrust previous experience or explanations from those who are more cautious about moving mountains and rushing into battle than youth ready to pick up the gauntlet for any cause. Many movements for revolution are launched from universities by students bent on changing the course of history. It is not that their causes are necessarily wrong. However, there is often an abundance of adrenaline in those purposes and somewhat less substance to maintain the momentum. If we set out on a work of consecration, let us heed the words of Luke 14:28-30 from the New International Version. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost to see if he has enough money to complete it? For if he lays the foundation and is not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule him, saying, "This fellow began to build and was not able to finish." In the school of Christ, we are the students. He is the teacher. Others have gone before us, and they are our tutors. It is presumptuous for us to tell our teacher how and what to teach us while we are beginning our studies. Such are the impulses of youth, however. Yet we must not give up zeal and the vision, else we will not persevere to finish the course. Fortunately, zeal and the vision are also assets of youth, very valuable assets. The energy and the vision. When I consecrated at 17 years of age, I had the good fortune to meet some good old soldiers of the cross who had labored in the heat of the day, fought the battles for truth, and stood for principles through decades of change. Some had already been consecrated for 50 or 60 years and more. Even then, I hesitate to mention names in a discourse. It conjures up different perspectives of different brethren, but I might just take that liberty for a moment. And some of you remember these names. There was Brother and Sister Morehouse. There was the Sunbombs, the Bakers, the Livermores, the Collimans. There was Brother Zeno, the Megasons, Brother Loomis, Brother Reed, Brother King Barrett, Brother Wylam, the Hollister brothers. And there's others. You each have your set of mentors in your early experiences of the truth. These were some of mine. What a joy to meet them, even in their declining years. Some of you knew them longer than I, and some of you knew others of even greater antiquity. But being of somewhat timid nature, I stood in awe of the stature of these scholars of experiential knowledge. I loved to hear their stories of contending for truth, witnessing in the face of prison, some being run out of town, of tracting whole towns and villages single-handedly, and establishing new ecclesias, traveling to foreign lands, some at Brother Russell's direction, of being hired from Christendom for professional singing on Bible student tours, and later being transformed by the message that was heard, of standing in World War I trenches, defying orders by firing over enemy heads, only to recognize a cross and crown pin on a Bible student brother in enemy trenches doing the same. I could not hear enough of these accounts of organizing the principles and vision of truth. I knew I had a long way to go before walking in their shoes, or yet resisting unto blood. They were grand teachers. Their lessons are burned into my memory. After 35 years, I still haven't caught up to them. But I know who my teachers are. They are those who practice their faith and put it to the test. They are those who were careful about both the letter and spirit of the word. They are those who left the next generation the tools to learn from their discoveries. And I know who their teachers were. They were the prophets, the patriarchs, apostles, and fathers in Zion. And their teacher is the Son of God. And brethren, I long to meet them again someday and tell them that their labors and words did not fall on deaf ears. our labors are not in vain. How is it with you? Are you doing your homework? There are no shortcuts. Homework is essential. It consists of reading the scriptures, reading the expositors that God has used, of reading some visionary, inspiring, and classical themes. When have we last considered the volumes, the six volumes, and meditated on their contemporary message? But homework also includes some laboratory work, of putting the vision to work, to put our shoes to the street, to comfort those that mourn, to restore the crippled in spirit, to display the truth on unpopular causes for the sake of principle, to lift up the weary hands, to weep with those who weep, to patiently bear with those in undone conditions of this world, to provide the truth, to prove the truth, rather, in the crucible of your own life and your own opportunities. It's like a hot iron from the fire and taking it and thrusting it into the oil to temper the steel. If we come through with a more holistic view of humanity and ourselves, it will prepare us to go again to the vision and fuel further endeavor until the work is done. New creature work is a transformation, a renewing process, similar to a metamorphosis more than a single rapturous experience, more a tempering of steel than the elation of first coming into Christ. It is sacrifice, it is service, it is forbearance, endeavor as good soldiers of the cross. A good soldier does not cumber himself with material things and concerns, or even his own comfort. He does not debate his cause and question his purpose. He perseveres for the sake of the vision and the hope that is before him. We understand that Daniel was at peace in the den of lions, just as he would be in the palace of kings. We might never know whether it was so with us unless we have faced some lions in our own time. But all good soldiers are not necessarily in the front lines, nor always bedding down with lions. Some tend home fires and nourish and comfort others. Some carry water or send messages of courage to those who faint in battle. They mend clothes, as did Dorcas, bind up wounds, and pray for the victory. Every campaign needs every active body member, and victory will belong to the whole family of Christ and not to one or two. Free grace means it came to us without our merit. It does not mean that it is free of responsibility and commitment. Well, brethren, this is all very idealistic, and philosophy is easy to talk about. But there are those who went before us who struggled with real lessons of heart and head. I want to cite a few experiences of the past, just as examples from the scriptures. You know that they had struggles of heart and head. Consider Jeremiah, who said, "I will not make mention of him nor speak any more in his name. But his word was in my heart as a burning fire, shut at my bones, and I was weary with forbearing, and I could not stay." There was a struggle there. Consider David and Jonathan, who broke company while Saul's wrath was hot. Consider what was going on with David's heart when he arranged for Uriah to die on the forefront of battle. Consider Ruth, who persisted against Naomi's advice to stay with her own people. Consider Samson, who told the secret of his strength to Delilah. Later, he determined to die while destroying a Philistine temple. Many other examples. Joseph was tested and then blessed his brothers who sold himself into slavery. Daniel and his friends chose not to defile themselves at the king's table, but Daniel chose to attend and serve a pagan king. Paul disregarded the advice of brethren, proceeded to Jerusalem and the temple, and was taken by a Roman authority. Jesus told his disciples not to go into the way of the Gentiles, yet he healed the daughter of a Syrophoenician woman who pleaded to his heart. What prompted and guided these choices? Life's experiences may tell us not to trust, that we were left alone in the storm before, that brethren know nothing of our experiences or our condition. But brethren, others have gone before us. And I want you to know that I have prayed for many of you here when no words were even exchanged. I want you to know that I need your experiences and lessons to see something through your eyes when my vision is too narrow and self-focused. Our life and lessons are not finished. Our experiences are not even, equal, just, or even fair at times. One has health, another has pain of the flesh for many years. One prospers in the temporal estate. Another can hardly lift their head above poverty. One has supporting, fulfilling family experiences. Another is denied. One easily manages fleshly indulgence. Another constantly fights temptation. Our heart may complain, and our head may rationalize, or else we may bear our experiences when they cannot be changed. We can learn through adversity. We can bear the consequences of our folly as good disciples, or we can choose to blame others. It is simply a matter of choice, not calamity. We have the power to choose our attitudes. Brethren, be part of the solution, not part of the problem. The world has problems enough without cursing the cause. We can curse the night or walk under the stars to see the handiwork of our Creator. We can curse the fire that burns our flesh or be thankful that it should be sacrificed so soon. It is a matter of choice. Our challenge, brethren, is to leave some fragrance behind on our journey, some oil of perfume. And this involves risk, to expose both our strength and our weakness, to face our fears, take the extra steps to forgive, truly to listen to instruction. It means to love others and tell them so, even when they are not lovable. To empower them to be so. It means saying, "Here am I, send me," even when we would rather be elsewhere. The work of our hearts, our feelings, character, our motives, and our mind, that aspect of understanding, reasoning, and conviction, is a maturing process, and neither can be neglected. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 13:11, "When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things." What does the Christian put away when he matures? He puts away fear, excuses, rationalization, prejudice, fantasies, illusion. These are the tools of childhood. But particularly, we put away our dependency on others for the consequences of our conduct. A child is fed and turned and bathed, and his messes are cleaned up after him. An adult will not only feed himself, but take responsibility for his mistakes and cleans up after himself, but also takes pleasure in the good effect his labors and plans make for the future. An adult will learn by his mistakes and use his victories as stepping stones. A responsible Christian takes pleasure in that his choices arise from within and not imposed externally. And so do we whine and fuss when we are not fed, when our needs are not being met, or do we go to the food and feed ourselves? And do we come prepared to feed others as an adult would? Near Portland are the Nike Corporation offices. They make athletic clothing, as you may know. And they have a slogan, "Just do it." That's their slogan, "Just do it." We cannot coast into worthy endeavors. We must take ourselves to task and just do it. It's mature. It's adult. Most of the battle is won when the decision and commitments are begun. Victory begins with choices. Without commitment and a cause, the issues of the heart and mind are in constant turmoil. We must dwell on beautiful themes, courageous ventures, daring dreams. Let them burn in our hearts. We must dwell on the rules of truth, prophecy, historical and contemporary issues, if we would have our mind's eye be clear. And the work is not yet done. The heart must consult the head for hope, the vision, and the cause for which to endure the rigors of life. It has been said that he who has a why to live can bear with almost any how. The clearer the eye, the stronger the heart. It was observed in the concentration camps of Europe that those who had hope and a reason to live could endure nearly with any deprivation. And when faced with death, they died with courage and dignity, knowing their cause would survive their transient life. Those without hope often died of their own demoralization, even before the ultimatum fell on their shoulders. Those who could look to each day as the ultimate goal, or those who could look to each day as the only goal of their pleasure, will find in every corner despair. Because our goal is longer than today and its difficulties. Only when we can see beyond the storm do we have the power to prevail. When a man finds his place in God's plan, he can accept suffering as part of his task. He will acknowledge that even in suffering, he can find unique opportunity in the way he bears his burden. He can bring light and joy to others in the midst of his own struggle. The world has a saying, "That which does not kill me makes me stronger." But brethren, consider this. Our axiom exceeds even this, in that that which takes our life brings us victory and will empower us to be instruments of blessings to mankind. Once we are convinced that when we rest from our labors, our works will follow us beyond the veil, we are moved to do the works of him who called us out of darkness into his marvelous light, this side the veil. We understand that our labor in the King's service is not in vain and will endure beyond this transient life. We are in preparation for our role beyond this schooling, when we understand that our experiences will bear fruit for eternity. We need not despair
of our immediate burdens and their consequences. Anything endured now is but an opportunity to reaffirm our vision of the future. As the work progresses, our joy will be more calm and peaceful. Our spiritual maturity will beget a mellowness, an assurance that will not only be trustworthy with the divine nature, but will be prepared to care for and guide humanity back to the idyllic state where love wells up in every heart and there will be no more pain and no more curse. May God add his blessing.
Thank you, Brother Leslie, for this very sober and very encouraging lesson for us in our Christian walk on heart and head, two components that are so necessary as we endeavor to be pleasing to the Master and developed as earnest Christians. We'll ask, as Brother Leslie closes with prayer, if we could ask a blessing upon our meal and our fellowship together at that time.
Gracious Father in heaven, hallowed be thy holy name. We want to learn to reverence thee more, to use thy Holy Spirit provided for us. We want to learn of thy will and ways for us, to understand thy plan more clearly, and to walk in Jesus' footsteps. We thank thee for his great sacrifice, for his example. We thank thee for this convention, for the fellowship provided, and for this noontime meal together, the temporal and spiritual provisions bountifully provided. We are grateful. Keep us humble and teachable. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.